7. On Saturday night, a visitor rapped at Ludwig Grimmelman's locked metal door.
"Who is it?"
Grimmelman said, not recognizing the knock. From a wall rack, he took down an Army M1 rifle, sweeping up the secret documents and reports he'd been preparing. He stuffed them into a briefcase, closed the snap, and pushed them into a hiding place. He turned off the light and stood in darkness, hearing his own breathing.
"What do you want?"
"Mr. Grimmelman," the voice said, a man's voice. Grimmelman went to a side window, unfastened the catch, raised it, and peered out. A man was standing in the outside stairwell, a heavy-set man in a top coat, wearing a hat and a pressed suit. He was middle-aged. He seemed to be a salesman, probably an insurance salesman. Putting his light back on, Grimmelman unlocked and opened the door.
"I'm busy. I refuse to buy anything."
The man said, "I'm Ralph Brown, from the FBI. He flapped open a black leather identification folder. "I'd like to step in a moment and discuss a matter with you, if I may."
"What's this about?"
He backed away as Mr. Brown entered.
"About a fellow you might know."
Brown glanced about the room. "Quite a place you've got here." He strolled leisurely.
"What fellow?"
"Ever heard of an individual by the name of Kendallman? Leon Kendallman? We thought you might know him. Here's his picture." Mr. Brown, from the deep pocket of his topcoat, brought forth a packet. He opened the packet and handed Grimmelman a snapshot, blurred, indistinct. But nonetheless, the snapshot was familiar.
"Why?"
Grimmelman demanded. "Draft evasion." Grimmelman returned the snapshot.
"No, I never saw him. And anyhow, your organization is infiltrated by communists. It's no use talking to you. It goes straight to MVD hatchet men in the labor school and around the PW.
"You never saw this individual?"
"No."
"Positive?"
"No, I never saw him."
He was terrified because the snapshot, taken from a distance with a telescopic lens, was of him. Mr. Brown said, "May I see your draft card?" The card was in a locked box under the table, along with other papers. Larson, the printer, whom Art worked for, had done it. At one time, Larson had been an organizer for a splinter Trotskyist organization, of which Grimmelman had been a member. Studying the card, Mr. Brown said,
"You're 26? "Yes," he said. "Born in Warsaw, naturalized in 1932.
"You're 4F? Mr. Brown said, returning to the card. "How'd you work that? You look all right to me."
"Hernia,"
Grimmelman said. "And you're positive you don't know this Kendallman?" Actually, there was no Kendallman. He had registered under that name, and he used it now and then in covert political work, undercover work such as spying on fascist student groups, Stalinist fronts, and for taking out library books he did not mean to return.
"Positive," he said.
He wished Mr. Brown, the FBI man, would leave. He wished it more than anything else on earth. The wish became a passion. In fact, if Mr. Brown did not leave, he would fall dead in his tracks. The sense of danger was too much. He could not bear it. "Quite a place you got here," Mr. Brown said, picking up some photostats of Pravda. "You're interested in politics, Mr. Grimmelman?" Mr. Brown showed no sign of leaving. On the contrary, the more he saw, the more interested he seemed to become. Joe Mantilla said, "He says it's time to get out the horch. He says we're supposed to go start it up and make sure the engine's tuned." He leaned from the window of his 39 Plymouth toward Art Emanuel, who stood at the curb. Behind the Plymouth, other cars, the traffic along Fillmore, honked and flashed their headlights and swung around.
"I'll go get Heinke. You can come now, or we'll pick you up on the way back."
"Pick me up on the way back," Art said. "Okay, that'll be in around 15 minutes. Mantilla held his watch up to the light from the cars behind. 10:05. Art walked back up the path and down the steps to the apartment. Behind him, the Plymouth, popping and sputtering, gunned off and was gone. The nighttime traffic resumed its regular flow. Closing the front door, he said to Rachel, "We can't go out tonight. I have to do something.
She said, Was that about Grimmelman? She had put on a coat, and now, in the bathroom, she was combing her hair. They had been about to leave for the bowling alley. She liked to watch the players and be where there was noise and activity and kids her own age, especially on Saturday night. It looks like we might be doing something, Art said. He was uneasy. He knew how she felt about Grimmelman and the organization.
It's up to you, she said. But he's so peculiar. I mean, he sits up there all day. He never goes out. Is that what you really want?
I've got a lot invested in the Horch, he said. It had been his job to supply parts for engine repair.
There's something wrong with him, she said, taking off her coat.
That's what Nat says.
I think you go over there, she said, because you can't find anything else to do. If you had something else, you'd do it instead.
Maybe you're right, he mumbled, standing first on one foot and then the other.
When will you be back tonight?
Probably late. He did not really want to go, but he had to. Will you be okay? He asked hesitantly.
I might go to a show.
I'd kind of feel better if you stayed home.
Okay, she said. I will.
Could we sometime play poker again? That was an eternal love of hers. She played a tight game, without talk or motion. Straight or draw poker, with no variations and no cards wild. Usually, she won a dollar or two. She had frightened off most of Art's high school friends, who liked to play goofy, extravagant games with a great deal of horseplay. Once, she'd slapped Ferda Heinke and knocked off his glasses because, in dealing, he had kiddingly turned over a card. They're all scared to play cards with you, he said. You take it too seriously.
There's no such thing, she said.
It isn't a game when you play.
Poker isn't a game, she said.
What do you think it is? Do you think it's like hearts or something?
That's the trouble with you. You can't tell what's important and what isn't. You're going out to fool around, and you don't know if you're playing a game. It would be playing revolutionary, I guess. Nazi or something, with that car. But you also think you really are a revolutionary and it isn't a game. So, which are you? You're sort of between. Do you know what this is here? Me and this apartment and you? This isn't a game either. And if you go out there and horse around with them and I don't think you're coming back here, not as soon as you should anyhow, then I'm going to bust you one.
She looked at him with that sharp, intent look that was so frightening. Nobody stood up against that. She would demolish the apartment and everything in it. She would lay it waste. And she would not say a word. She would just go about it. And for weeks, she would say nothing to him. She would go to work, fix the meals, shop, clean, and sweep the apartment, and never speak to him. The thing about her that was so awe-inspiring was that she never kidded. She never joked. She meant everything she said. It was not boast. It was prophecy. Taking her in his arms, he kissed her. Her face was cold, her lips, always thin, were dry. He kissed her on the cheek, and he felt the bone close to the surface. He felt the hardness. "You're pretty tough," he said. "I just want you to know." She smiled up at him then. He said, "What else can I do? I have to go."
"You don't have to go."
"I'm supposed to." He was helpless.
"You don't have to do anything. Nobody can make you do anything. All these things they say, it's just a lot of words. Grimmelman is as bad as the rest of them. Grimmelman is like a sign.
Do you do what signs say?
How about when you read something? Do you do that?
Do you believe it because it's up there on the wall or somebody mails it to you in an envelope? You know it's just words. Just talk." He said, "I do some things they tell me."
"Don't do anything they tell you."
"All of them?" Her hardness troubled him. "Remember all that stuff they taught us in school, all that junk? There never was anything in all of it." With her long, accurate fingers, she looped a thread that dangled from his shirt. She broke the thread and put it into an ashtray on the mantel. He placed his hands on her shoulders. Through the material of her blouse, his hands rested on her, and he felt that she was close to him,
close to the surface. "I wish we could go somewhere," she said. "Not just around here. I want to see different places. Maybe someday we could see the Rockies. We could drive up high. We could even live up there. They have towns up there, right in the mountains." "It's hard to get a job there," he said. "We could open a store," Rachel said. "There's always things people want. We could open a bakery." "I'm not a baker," he said. "Then we could put out a newspaper." He kissed her again, and then he lifted her up, off the floor, and against him. Then he set her down on the arm of the couch. "Tell your brother Nat," she said, "to give us one of his cars so we can drive. Tell him we need a new one. We can sell when we get there." "You mean it?" he said. Of course she did. "But not yet," she said. "We better wait until after I have the baby. Then we can go. In a couple of years, when we have some money. When you're finished being an apprentice." "You really want to get out of here?" After all, he thought, she had been born here. She had grown up here. She said, "Maybe we could even go up into Canada. I was thinking about that. To one of those towns where they trap animals and there's a lot of snow." "You wouldn't like that," he said. But, he thought, maybe she would. The Horch was parked in a sheet metal garage down in the flat industrial section of the city. Grimmelman, in his black wool greatcoat, paratrooper's boots, and army shirt, unlocked the padlock and shoved aside the doors. The garage was clammy. The cement floor was wet with oil. To one side was a workbench. Joe Mantilla put on the overhead light as Art Emanuel closed the doors behind him. "Nobody's been here," Furtis said. "Nobody's got to it." The Horch was dented from its encounters, but it was still impressive. It weighed almost 6,000 pounds. This car had come up from Latin America. It had been built in 1937 by the Auto Union, and this model, a five-passenger sport convertible, had been the staff car of the Wehrmacht and SS. Grimmelman had never told anyone how and where he had gotten hold of it, or how much he had paid. The Horch was painted jet black, and with its remote control system, it was unique. Art got in behind the wheel and started up the engine. In the closed garage, the noise deafened them. Exhaust fumes billowed up in clouds, and the smell of gasoline was sickening. "It's missing a little," Furta Heinke said. Lifting the hood, Art began tinkering with the fuel mixture. "How come you decided to roll out tonight?" he said to Grimmelman. He had never seen Grimmelman so agitated, in such a state of anxiety. "The time has arrived," Grimmelman said, pacing in a circle, his hands behind his back. "Is that why you're jumping around?" Furta Heinke said, "If we're really going to do something tonight, we better get more to go. Four isn't enough. We ought to get the rest of the organization." The organization faded off indistinctly, without particular edges. Beyond the hardcore were a number of members who came and went. "This is more in the nature of a warm-up," Grimmelman said, attaching the relay board of the remote control unit. With a screwdriver, he cinched up the lugs to the terminals. Perspiration streaked his cheeks. His face shone under the light. "A dry run, so we'll know we're ready to roll at an instant's notice." "Roll where?" Joe said. "The situation is at a critical stage," Grimmelman said. "I want the Horch filled with gas, ready for a long trip. If necessary, we may have to move operations to a new area." As he completed the wiring of the vital control unit, he added, "From now on, I want the weapons kept here in the Horch." "Where are we going tonight?" Furta Heinke asked. "We'll conduct practice maneuvers in the vicinity of Dodo's. If possible, we'll engage a Bactrian vehicle." "Fine," Joe Mantilla said, hating the Bactrians with their cashmere sweaters and slacks and Argyle socks, their country club dances, and especially their late-model Detroit stock cars. "See if the coast is clear," Grimmelman said, panting with eagerness. Furta stepped outside and surveyed the street. "I'll take the Plymouth," Joe Mantilla said, passing through the doorway and outside after Furta. He carried with him the controls and a microphone, and a roll of cable with a jack on the end. Let's see if I can back it out.
Seated in the Plymouth, he punched buttons, controlling the horch. The power-assisted wheel of the horch revolved as the car shifted gear and began to back. The original 8-speed manual transmission had been removed, and an automatic BorgWarner transmission installed. The overhead cam engine, with its immense crankshaft supported by 10 bearings, was original equipment. Nothing else was its match. The engine thundered, and the horch backed from the garage into the street. Its headlights flashed on. It shifted into a forward gear, and the foot throttle eased. From the grill beneath the Auto Union insignia, Joe Mantilla's voice boomed, "Okay, let's go."
"Great," Grimmelman said, hurrying outside. Art closed the garage doors. The three of them hurried to the Plymouth to join Joe Mantilla.
Joe drove the Plymouth while Grimmelman worked the controls for the horch. The ponderous horch started out ahead of them, and they followed closely. It was necessary for them to be near enough to see what lay ahead. In the beginning, their control car had lagged, and the horch had been permitted to crash against parked cars and curbs. Now they had learned to keep it always in sight. Its headlights swept the pavement, and over its open top, they studied the street.
"Turn it right," Furtis said.
The horch turned cautiously as Grimmelman slowed it almost to a halt.
"More traffic," Grimmelman murmured.
His face was tense with the strain of operating the controls.
"That's no lie," Furta Heinke said. "Hey, you want me to go take it manually until we're at Dodo's?"
"No," Grimmelman said. "It's okay."
The open horch, with no one inside, sailed down Fillmore Street among the buses and taxis and stock cars. As usual, its empty driver's seat was unnoticed.
"Art," Grimmelman said, "you operate the assault weapon."
Reaching around on the floor of the Plymouth, he was crowded in the back seat with Furta Heinke and piles of equipment. He located the assault weapon, a spray gun filled with white enamel paint. But he did not feel in the mood. The spray gun was a dead weight, and he handed it to Furta.
"You get them," he said.
"What's the matter?" Grimmelman demanded. "I told you to do it."
He shook his head.
"I don't know. I don't feel like it."
Ahead of them was Dodo's. At the curb, a sparkling new Detroit bomb was parked. Its occupants were inside the drive-in, at the counter.
"Bactrians," Grimmelman said.
The car was a 56 Buick, dark green and white.
"Park the horch," Joe said excitedly.
Grimmelman caused the horch to glide to the curb at the end of the block. There, with its motor idling, it parked and waited.
"No," Grimmelman said.
Furta Heinke, leaning from the window of the Plymouth, sprayed paint on the green fender of the Buick, spelling out, "Fuck you."
"Okay," he said, finishing. "Let's go."
Art lay back against the seat as the Plymouth shot forward. His heart was not in it, and he began to think about Rachel. Behind them, the Bactrians were rushing out of Dodo's and into their Buick. But he did not care.
"Stop," Grimmelman ordered Joe. "Around the corner like before."
The Plymouth screeched around the corner, past the parked horch, and came to a stop. At the drive-in, the Bactrians were starting up their Buick. As the Buick left the curb, Grimmelman propelled the horch from its parking place out into traffic, into the path of the Buick.
"Lily Whitehurst,"
the horch's speaker boomed at the Buick as the Buick swerved past it, trying to get around it. Now the horch blocked the side street and prevented the Buick from turning. The Buick went on past with the horch following. Joe Mantilla backed the Plymouth onto Fillmore and followed after the horch. Ahead of the horch, the Buick snaked from side to side as the Bactrians stuck their heads out and peered back, bewildered.
"Lily Whitehurst,"
the horch's speaker thundered, a gross and magnified voice directly behind them. They could easily see that nobody was at the wheel. The horch was frighteningly empty.
"Speed it up," Furta said to Grimmelman.
The horch gained on the Buick and slammed against its rear bumper. The Bactrians, in panic, spun around the corner and vanished. They had given up. The encounter was over.
"Okay," Grimmelman said. "That's enough."
Joe Mantilla halted the Plymouth in a driveway as Grimmelman turned the horch in a ponderous U-turn. Presently, they were following it back in the direction they had come.
"What's the matter?"
Furta Heinke said to Art, digging him in the ribs.
"Nothing?"
He felt glum. For the first time, he had failed to enjoy an encounter. Grimmelman said,
"He wants to go home."
"That's right," he said. An uncomfortable silence fell over them. "Maybe next time," Art said. "I got a lot of worries this week." Both Joe Mantilla and Ferda Heinke were glancing at him apprehensively, but Grimmelman ignored him. He concentrated on the task of directing the horch. "Christ," Art said, "it's not my fault. I got a lot of responsibilities." His apology went unanswered.